Romans 9 today. I don't know if we will not revisit it in April, but I would potentially get through the rest of chapter 9. So we had looked back in Romans 9, and I'm not going to go back and cover everything that we covered because this is a different lesson. But in verse 16, it says, "So then it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that sheweth mercy." And so Paul's statement that we're coming into here is that it is not the will of man. Man can't make it happen. Man can't hope it into existence. We can't claim it, frame it, and name it. We don't have a human prophetic claim to anything that God does. It is only him. And then Paul also used the word runneth, which is, implies any physical effort that we can apply. So there's nothing physically that we could do. And I said we could be so bold as to take all the physical efforts of every human that ever was and ever will be and put it together, and it doesn't do anything to change God. The creation can never change the Creator. But it is strictly of God that sheweth mercy. And he has determined the outcome. And people want to say that we are predestined for what we do. What is the futility if God knows exactly what he's going to do with me? And the fact is, he knows what our actions are going to be because he knows everything, but he does not dictate what our choice is. We have choice. What he has predetermined is that those who do serve him have his mercy. But those who reject his mercy are subject to wrath. And the examples that we saw were Moses and Isaac, but more importantly, we saw Moses trying to fulfill God's promise on his own with Ishmael because Sarah was barren. And when God touched her and she had a child, it was God's doing. And we saw it again, just so it's not a fluke, it's also happened with Rebekah, who was barren, and Isaac entreated God. And it tells us that it's not anything that we do, but it is his promise and his fulfilling of the promise. He doesn't make a promise that we can fulfill it. He will fulfill his purpose. And then we talked about Jacob and Esau, how Esau was the firstborn, but he despised his birthright. He didn't treat it. So even though we are given gifts, it's still up to us to treat it appropriately. We don't despise his mercy. And the third example was of Pharaoh, how Pharaoh's heart was hardened by not listening to God. I'm sorry, I'm finding it very distracting with this microphone instead of the... So I'm doing this because normally I'd be wringing my hands because that's my nervous fidget. So anyways, so Pharaoh hardened his heart despite God showing mercy over and over again. And yet, as man, we want to say that God made Pharaoh's heart harden. That is not the case, because over and over and over again, he gave Pharaoh the opportunity to repent and demonstrated that God is God, and Pharaoh wasn't. And so after all this discourse, Paul's question says, or Paul's stating is, man's response is, why does God judge me if everything I do is going to serve him anyways? I mean, who can resist him if he is the creator, right? And we're creation and we can't resist him. Well, why can't I do what I want if he's going to get what he wants anyways? Why am I not free to do whatever I want when I want? Paul's response is basically, who is creation to call the creator to task? And last week we looked at, we are created in his image. He breathed into us the breath of life. And we are his workmanship. But the bottom line is, we are still creation. Workmanship does not put us on a pedestal. God's love for us does not put us on a pedestal. It is his greatness. All things were created by him, for him. And in the verses we looked at, the imagery of the potter as the creator occurs in the Old Testament multiple times, and this is the imagery that he brings in, is that it's his work that determines what creation will be, where he says that same lump will be a vessel of unto honor or a vessel unto dishonor. Now, I want to deviate for a little bit and go into 2 Timothy 2, where our other main text was. And we're going to start at verse 15, but we're going to travel a little bit through it. So if you want to turn there, you're welcome to. Otherwise, you can listen along just fine. But it starts with, study to shew thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Now, my mind immediately goes to a workman that needeth not to be ashamed. Growing up in the trades, as a youngly licensed in a baby face, many people did not trust me to be able to do my job. There was many times where I can say that the customer locked the door and called the company to say, is this person really coming from you? I'm serious, that happened. And talking on the radio, no. And I remember one time, and maybe this is just my arrogance, I said, well, feel free to ask me any HVAC question. If I can't answer it, I'll leave. What's your questions? And I let him ask all the questions, and I answer him, and I said, okay, well, you knew more than the last guy who was much older than you, so come on in. That's not bragging. I guess it is bragging. But I was a workman that need not be ashamed in my work. I had done all the diligence necessary to become a workman. Not an apprentice, but a workman. There's a difference. You don't give the apprentice the engine to rebuild. You let them unscrew the oil filter. And then you tell them exactly how many quarts of oil to put in. And then you double check two or three times to make sure they didn't overfill it. And of course, you make sure they put the new filter back on. But that's where my brain goes right to, is immediately workmen. But the truth is, we overlook what the word study means. Spoudadzo. And that's as much Greek as you're going to get out of me. But that word study doesn't necessarily mean to stick your nose in the books and to just read about it. We know there's a difference between book knowledge and functional knowledge. But the word study here means to endeavor, to give all diligence. If I may be so bold, it means to cast everything else aside and make this your number one priority. Make this the number one thing in your life. Make this your goal, your focus, what you strive to. We talked many times, the example of walking is if you look to the side, you're going to trail to where you're looking. That's the natural habit of your body, is you're going to walk where you're looking. And this is saying, get your eyes focused, do due diligence, make it straight ahead, walk directly toward that path. And we have to, why? To shew thyself approved unto God, rightly dividing the word of truth. And that struck me because we have way too many YouTube experts nowadays. I watched a video on it. I'm an expert now. Well, I've seen something about that, or I heard it in passing, or I read a Facebook post, so now I'm an expert in this field. I'm a Christian, and I said I'm a Christian, so now I know everything about God. Do you? Have you spent time in His Word? More importantly, have you spent time with Him? Have you really absorbed it? Have you handled it? The imagery I have is when I did sheet metal, I got a brand new tin knocking hammer. Now, there's a special hammer for it. It's lightweight, square head, meant for putting tin. The handle was beautiful, very smooth, leather wrapped, sealed in epoxy. You know what it did? It gave me blisters. But after years of work and using it over and over again, that hard epoxy became a soft handle. That ridges would just fit the bumps in my hand perfectly. That when you grabbed onto it by feel, you're like, oh, that's my hammer. You could pick up someone else's and it just, it's not quite right. I mean, I can do the job with it, but it's not mine. Have we showed ourselves workmen by being able to pick up His Word and it's comfortable in our hands? Because we've looked into it. Because we've seen him. Do we have that relationship where we can reach out our hand and we grab his, we know it's his that we're holding? Have we really become that workman whose tools our hands know by hold? Have we gotten to the point where we can hear his word and we can divide those things that are true and not true? Do we prove those things that are his? If we are the apprentice, we're going to get fooled. There's too many YouTube preachers. And I know the irony that you might be listening on YouTube in the future, so I get that. But again, the study is on an individual basis. It's up to each individual to study, to dig in. And continuing in 2 Timothy, it says, "But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness." And I think looking at the word profane means common, secular, non-biblical. And vain babblings is fruitless discussions. There's a lot of places I could go with that this morning. But I will think of the fun games that we try and do on road trips where someone in the car says, what's their superpower? And the next person has to say what the weakness is. It's utter nonsense. Total nonsense, but it bides time. But it's fruitless conversation. It doesn't build. Doesn't do anything. It passes time, but that's it. But do we fill ourselves with non-biblical conversation? Do we have fruitless discussions? You know, these things increase unto more ungodliness. And I'll say that kind of strikes me as odd, because you would think as a certain base amount of knowledge would be there. So at the very least, you might not grow, but you would stagnate, stay the same, right? It says, no, increase unto more ungodliness. And it goes further in verse 17. It says, and their word will eat as doth a canker, of whom is Hymenaeus and Philetus. Thank you, Brother Lou. I was going to say Philetus. But what is a canker? We've had a canker sore before, raw, chafed. But a canker is a symptom of something much deeper. It's a fungus, a bacteria, or a disease. It eats away the flesh, and it will go all the way down to the bone if untreated. And I thought it was interesting because they use a canker most commonly in trees. And I was looking at the Morton Arboretum, is a website. It says a canker is rarely a symptom of an infection by various fungal and bacterial organisms. The pathogen often enters the host through an injury or open wound. Once the pathogen enters the wound, it can spread under the bark. Canker diseases frequently kill branches or structurally weaken them, making the infected branch more prone to storm damage. Further, canker disease organisms overwinter in existing spores. This disease causes organisms, they're not very strong of themselves, but they need a weakened host. Isn't that interesting? It needs a weakened host to get in. Most common on trees and shrubs under stress. Damage results when opportunistic fungal or bacterial pathogens enter a wound during stress, such as transplanting, drought, or winter. Other stress agents provide opportunities to include exposure to extremely high or low temperatures, flooding, summer, winter, hail, high winds, imbalances. You know, I can't help but think about all those things that came against Paul. Every one of those stressors in his life, we would have understood if, you know, some bacterial, some fungal got in there and caused a canker in Paul's. I mean, after all, wouldn't he justified having some rough spots because he's not happy in his circumstances? I mean, aren't we justified when things go not don't go our way? Absolutely not. But do they happen? Yeah. The truth is if we don't have ourselves armored, if we haven't showed ourselves studying, if we're not giving due diligence, we become a weakened host. Where things, the arrows that we would be able to block with the shield, penetrate. And it may not be the arrow puncturing that kills us. It might be the hurt or disease or bacteria that comes afterwards because we didn't get it cleaned. We didn't get it taken care of. And of those, in verse 18 it says, who concerning the truth have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrew the faith of some. Erred from the truth. It makes me think of 2 Peter 1:9 and 1:10. But he that lacketh these things is blind and cannot see afar off, and hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. Wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure, for if ye do these things, ye shall never fail. Now, I am not going to go to these things because I would love to spend a few classes on it, but these things start with faith. The definition of faith is in 2 Peter 1 through 4. Go look it up. But it is our personal, intimate knowledge of the person, plan, and identity of God that allows us to discern what he wants to do so that we can do it. And I know that wasn't the exact, but that puts it in my mind. We need to know who he is, what he wants, and act accordingly. See, the problem is when we lack these things, we become first blind. Blind as nothing can enter in. Light cannot enter. It is no longer penetrating our sight. Cannot see afar off as we become self-centered. We become the pinnacle. Like Job last week where we read that, if I could just find God and talk to him. Bless you. Talk about a self-centered, egotistical, and I'm seeing myself looking in a mirror with the rest of that definition. And it says, forgotten, he was purged of his old sins. You know, the thing about warnings, the reason they're there is because they need to be there. If we didn't need to be warned about these conditions, if it wasn't possible for us, we wouldn't need the warning. But the simple fact, it is very easy for us to forget these things unless we are studying, giving due diligence, making it the priority. You know, the thing about that verse, it also says, and overthrow the faith of some. That canker may be the sign of bacteria or fungus in you. But here's the thing, as you come in contact with other people all the time, and you don't know what you might spread. That thing that's causing you to eat away might infect someone else. It's not just yourself, but it's cautious for your brothers and sisters. But the next verse gives us hope. Starts with nevertheless. That breaks down. It doesn't matter what comes before this. This has no impact on the following. Nevertheless, this will never take away from the following. The foundation of God standeth sure. He is not changed. The mind may never fully comprehend, or the truth might not penetrate, but it doesn't change it. Man's mind does not change truth. And the biggest attack that we have on the truth is the phrase that truth is subjective. Truth is not subjective. He has declared, that is the truth, Anything else is vanity. It's self-centered, putting oneself on a pedestal. It says, having this seal, and that seal implies ownership. That signet ring, marking it as mine. The Lord knoweth them that are his. So let me ask this question. Who are not his? Yeah, that contradicts some of our thinking, doesn't it? Well, I'm his. If you're not saved, you're not his. That's a prevalent thought in Christendom, isn't it? It is. Thank you. Everything is his. He knoweth everything that is his. But this part says, and let everyone that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity. That word nameth doesn't mean I call on it. It means when you bear it, when you take it upon, when that name is put upon you, when you claim to be under that dominion, depart, get away, clean break. Don't dabble in it. Don't live at the border. Don't live on the fence. You get to the center. You get to where that name is. And here's where we're tying into Romans. And I'm going to say, thank you, Bishop. But in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also of wood and of earth, and some to honor and some to dishonor. First of all, who owneth? God owneth. So whose house is it? His house. Gold, silver, wood, earth, unto honor or noble use, unto dishonor, non-noble, common use. You can dig deeper into that one. Romans 9:21 says, hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel to honor, one another to dishonor? He determines because creation is his. There is a gap here, though. There is something we got to pay attention. Because it says, if a man therefore purge himself from these, is he saying purge himself from these vessels? Purge himself from the great house? It's an important question. What are these? What are the things that man has to purge himself from? Profane, non-biblical lifestyle, vain babblings, a lifestyle that at best is considered neutral. Doesn't Paul say not all things are profitable? Well, this is what you're saying, is those things that aren't profitable, get rid of. Definitely get rid of those things that take away, but get rid of the neutral things. And also, don't be cankerous. Don't be unarmed. Don't be subject to the whims that come along. Don't let it get into your skin spiritually. We're not talking scabies here. But don't let it get into your skin. Don't let it create a bacteria. Don't let it weaken you. Don't let the strength that God wants for you in the armor to be penetrated by the things of this world that have no place in his kingdom. We are told instead that we are to study, to endeavor, to give all diligence to those things that are of his kingdom. And what happens? He shall be a vessel unto honor. Which one? He. The ones, that also includes she, so put the stones down. It's those that purge themselves shall be vessels unto honor, sanctified and meet for the master's use and prepared unto every good work. Now, that does not mean you're going to be a pepperoni and cheese platter. That's not what the word meat means, okay? That word meat means profitable. If you want to be profitable in his kingdom, these things need to be purged. Prepared for every good work. We are profitable when we give all diligence to hasten his kingdom and not ours. And it says, prepared unto every good work. And that word prepared, the connotation to it in the imagery is drawn from Oriental custom of sending one before kings on their journey to level the road and make it passable. In other words, remove those things that might hinder his kingship. And it's funny, is the next verse, flee also youthful lusts, also and flee. Isn't our focus in our life, we start with flee youthful lusts and then know him. Flee also, know him first, period, and then fleeing youthful lust will be beneficial, will be possible. Again, there is a warning there because it's easy to fall into, regardless of who you are. A warning is necessary to say, danger, stay away. Know him first, and he is willing to be known. Back in Romans 9:22, it says, what if God, willing to shew his wrath and to make his power known, endureth with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction? What are those vessels? The ones that do not purge themselves of vain babblings. The ones that don't purge themselves of profanity. Those that have become cankerous because things have come in and weaken the vessel. I don't need a bucket with a hole in it. I would buy a basket instead. One thing that I find very interesting, he does not make the vessels fitted to destruction. That is our doing. The next verse says, and that he might make known the riches of his glories on vessels of mercy. Here's where that comes in, which he had afore prepared unto glory. Man makes himself vessels fit to be destroyed. His purpose is that we be vessels prepared unto glory. Vessels of mercy. And then it makes sense what Paul says is, even us, whom he hath called, not only the Jews only, but also the Gentiles. Again, who hath he called? He hath called everyone. This applies to all of us. But those that walked after the Spirit, and we spent a few weeks on that, are those who purged themselves. Vessels of gold, vessels of silver, vessels of wood, vessels of earth. All these vessels are in his house. But are we purged, profitable, and prepared for him? And then we see the examples of his long suffering of the vessels fit for destruction. As he had saith also in Hosea, I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. And that is mirrored in Hosea 2:23. And I will sow unto her me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, thou art my people, and they shall say, thou art my God. Israel played the harlot with God, ran to every other god that showed up and said, they have provided. But the truth is, God in his long suffering provided all the provision that they needed, and Israel took that provision and gave it to idols. And he says, if they don't turn back, I will take away things. And you can go back in Hosea, and I know I'm doing a very short. I'm finding I do a lot of just very short things. Sorry, there's just so much that ties in. Ready? Study to show thyself approved, handling the word of God. But he says, "Is I have created barriers, I will take away. I will no longer provide for you unless you return to me." And despite how Israel treated their relationship, he provided. And says, "Thou art my people." And they will say, "Thou art my God." His long suffering, because those vessels were fit for destruction because it was their own doing. Never once did he say, "I am making you destroy yourselves." It is, "You are refuting my mercy." In 27, Isaiah also crieth concerning Israel, "Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because a short work will the Lord make upon the earth." This ties right back into the very first part of chapter 9, where he says, "Not all who call themselves Israel are Israel." You might be a great people, but you have not purged yourselves to be my people. In verse 29, "And as Isaiah said before, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a seed, we had been as Sodoma and had been made like unto Gomorrah. We would have been utterly destroyed if it wasn't for his mercy." And Paul comes up with another question, as he does. What do we say then? What shall we say then? That the Gentiles which followed not after righteousness have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness which is of faith? But Israel which followed after the law of righteousness hath not attained the law of righteousness? Israel, what is your response to this? How can you now say, why does it matter what I do? How can you go and rebuke against the Creator when you see his mercy that he has bestowed upon his people, even us, not just our history, but on all of us who are reading this now? The Gentiles obtained righteousness, which is of faith. Israel followed the righteousness of the law. We talked about that. We can never fulfill the law, because the minute we break any part of it, we have broken the entire law. If you've ever driven 36 into 35, you have broken the law now and forever. You may not have been punished, but you broke the law. Israel was not chasing the right righteousness. Let that be a warning to us, that we chase the right righteousness, that we're not chasing the righteousness of the law, that we're chasing him. That's what the righteousness of faith is it's looking to him first and foremost. It says, "Wherefore, because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the works of the law, for they stumbled at that stumbling stone, as it is written, Behold, I lay in Sion a stumbling stone and rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed." 1 Peter 2, 6-10 says, "Wherefore also it is contained in the Scripture, Behold, I lay in Sion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded." There is no confusion when you see him. That chief cornerstone is the first stone laid in the foundation, and everything else lines up according to it. There is no confusion with our master builder, with the architect of the universe. There is no confusion. "Unto you therefore which believeth, he is precious. But unto them which be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the stone," this head of the corner. when they don't see him, they do not realize his beauty. We didn't realize his beauty until he revealed it. And a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient, whereunto also they were appointed. But thank God there's that word but. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, because of his doing. And there is a purpose. We aren't that to boast of ourselves. We're not that to toot our own horn. It's not a feather in our cap to show how fancy we are, but it is to show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Sounds an awful lot like purging ourselves of those things to be the vessels meet for him, prepared for him, for his use, which in times past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which have not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Why? They looked to the law and not to him. They knew the word of the law, but did not know him. The warning is there because it is important for us to heed the warning. It is important to know the word of the law. It is important to do due diligence to know what he says. But first and foremost, we need to know him. And I'm concluding. We can become very legalistic and lose focus on him. The problem with legalism is we no longer recognize ourselves for what we are. We think ourselves better than everyone else and lose sight of the fact that we are only here by his mercy and grace. And it's the same mercy and grace that calls that person that you despise, that you can't stand, that you're just absolutely appalled by. That is someone he died for. His long suffering is there. His mercy is for. Do we think our sin doesn't stink any less? If we become legalistic, the purpose disappears. Did you ever hear that phrase, we've always done it that way? I know how to do it because that's how I was taught, and they retired, and the next person was taught, and they retired. Well, why do we do it? We just do it that way. That happens with legalism. We just do it that way. Well, why do you do it? Because that's what we got to do to be saved. Well, why? Well, just we got to do it. Well, who? I don't know. This is just the behaviors we have. The truth is, if we live like that, we can flee all the youthful lusts we want. We will never be vessels meet for him. Unless we are studying to show ourselves handlers of his word, knowers of him. Again, endeavor, give all diligence to see him, to know him, to handle him. It is only by seeking him that we are purged, cleaned, profitable. We make ourselves prepared for his kingship. So as I've been trying to do, I leave you with this question this week. Is he a stumbling block or your chief cornerstone? Bishop, will you pray a closing for us?